Blog Talk Radio.
XBN, the Sex Worker Broadcast Network, at xxbn.net, broadcasting from Raleigh-Durham, Chapel Hill, a service of Swap East Media.
Hi, this is Amanda Brooks, and I am live right now, going to be interviewing Elizabeth Pisani. She has not called in yet, unfortunately. So I will play a bit of music for just a moment.
Hello?
Hello. Oh, good. There you are. Okay.
Sorry. I'm cutting it very fine.
Okay. This is Elizabeth Pisani, and she has written The Wisdom of Whores. It was released in May, and I finally got to read it just a couple of weeks ago, and it's an amazing book about the business of AIDS, and it also is about the business of sex and drugs, essentially, because this all ties into the battle against AIDS. And Elizabeth doesn't hesitate to dish dirt when she feels it's appropriate. And this might surprise people, but the dirt is not really with the sex workers and drug addicts. The dirt is with the governments and the agencies that fund AIDS, fund the fight against AIDS, and put the requirements in for the people who are truly trying to make a difference. Is that a good summary?
I think that's an excellent summary. I would say there's dirt on actually almost all sides, just because it's now such a huge industry. And there are more on some sides than on others. But yes, we're now talking about an industry that's running at $10 billion a year and rising. If the generosity of the U.S. taxpayer as a whole, it's going to rise very rapidly from next year because the new PEPFAR program, which stands, for those who don't know, for the PEPFAR, Purchasing Expensive Pharmaceuticals from American Retailers. No, it stands for the President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief, and that's now in front of the Senate waiting for authorization of another $50 billion over 5 years, and we're continuing to spend that money not very well, and I think that many people who are working quite hard at the front lines find that very frustrating.
Yes, that is one thing that came through so clear in your book, even though you don't hesitate to level criticism where it's necessary, including some of your own preconceived notions about AIDS and sex work and drug use. You have a clear passion for truly wanting to help the people who stand in line to get AIDS or the people who already have AIDS and are suffering. I mean, it comes through so clearly in your book. So I want to
Well, and I think it's...
Oh, go ahead.
Sorry, can I just say that, you know, my passion is actually to just get out the way and let people help themselves, because, you know, you find that actually a lot of the best solutions come from the people who are living with the problems. If we would just get out of the way and, you know, make the money available to make services available. So even more than, you know, I mean, one of the things that I found in the early days was we'd sit around in Geneva at the World Health Organization or in Washington at USAID and decide what people needed. And what you find is that actually people need different things in different places, and there's no one who knows what they need better than the sex worker or the drug injector or the, you know, rent boy or whoever it is. We just have to facilitate that in a better way.
Yes, and your passion comes through for that so clearly because, again, you're on the ground and bureaucrats, well, they're removed, obviously, and you see the problems and your frustration comes through, but you never forget that you're dealing with human beings. And I love that because it comes through so clearly in your book. You remember every single time that all the numbers you crunch, it's still people and human lives.
I'm very, very happy that has come through, because I do feel it really strongly, and I do think that it's so easy when you stand up at, you know, one conference after another and you're showing these slides with data to a bunch of other nerds like yourself, and, you know, we're turning... The data now are absolutely flabbergasting. I mean, 2.5 million people were infected with HIV last year around the world. It's a preventable disease. It's an easily preventable disease. It's a cheaply preventable disease. We're 20 years and more into the epidemic, and we're still allowing 2.5 million people to be infected. But when the numbers get that big, our eyes just glaze over, and it just becomes numbers. And it's like every single one of those people is someone's mother, someone's son, someone's brother, someone's lover, someone's airline pilot, you know. It's very easy to forget that when you deal with the magnitude of the numbers.
Which brings us back to the PEPFAR, $10 billion a year to be pledged over the next 5 years, in addition to the billions already being poured into AIDS. So what do you think is going to happen to this new infusion of cash? Do you think it's going to have the effect it's supposed to have?
I think it will depend to an extent what happens in the elections, to be honest. I think that, you know, there will be a change of administration. We just don't know how big a change there will be. But I think that will have a profound impact on how this is spent. But I do think that right now, there's one large distortion in the money, and it's very difficult to talk about. In fact, it's so difficult to talk about that no one's talking about it. And that is that a huge amount of this money is earmarked for treatment. Now, that's a very good thing, because drugs keep people alive, which is great. Antiretroviral, you know, expensive, complex antiretroviral regimes keep people alive for much longer than they would otherwise live. That's great. But, of course, they also increase the size of the problem. And some people, when I say that, say, how can you say that? That's outrageous. How can you say that treatment makes the problem bigger? And it's like, that's not an opinion. It's just arithmetic. If people are staying alive longer, then there are more people living with the disease. That's with the infection in the case of HIV. That's just maths. But it does mean that we really have to think about what we do on the prevention side, because more people living more healthy lives, which is a great thing, also means that they're living healthier sex lives, possibly going back to drug injection. So it means that they're also in a position to pass HIV on. Now, there is an impact HIV treatment, antiretroviral treatment, does bring down the amount of virus in the blood, and that makes it harder to pass on. But in every country where we've got very good access to treatment now, in the populations that we've measured, that we've tracked for the longest, which is mostly among gay men, we're seeing new infections rising where treatment is becoming more common. So you cannot just fund treatment without also funding prevention, and more prevention and more effective prevention. And there's nothing in the current PEPFAR bill that's doing that.
Yes, they're cutting down on prevention, and essentially if you're just worried about treatment, you're trying to clean up the problem as opposed to stopping the problem. And of course,
that's right.
Well, it is. And one of the big, big problems, even mainstream people are starting to notice two of the large problems in the PEPFAR funding as far as prevention goes is their adherence to abstinence-only programs and their anti-prostitution pledge.
Oh, and there's a third one, actually, which is no clean needles for drug injectors.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah, no, well, it's not as explicit as the other two, because it derives from regulations which actually also apply domestically to federal funding in the states. But in terms of HIV prevention in all of Asia, Eastern Europe and Latin America, it's one of the key things. Now, the abstinence thing, I'm glad to say, the good news is that that earmark as a specific regulation has been dropped in the new legislation.
Good.
So that's gone. But the anti-prostitution oath, or whatever you want to call it, the anti-prostitution pledge, is still very much there. And to be honest, I am absolutely scandalized that that's gone through what's now a Democrat-controlled Congress.
Nobody wants to stand.
How do we let that stay in there?
Because nobody wants to put their foot down and really care about sex workers, or at least that's my theory anyway. Perhaps, or they believe all the trafficking hysteria, and I guess they're following a new trend, which is all prostitution is trafficking. I mean, that seems to be the...
Well, we've seen a really, just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen a tragic consequence of that belief. I don't know if you've followed what's been happening in Cambodia last couple of weeks. But, well, yes, you have, because you've been blogging about it. And, you know, it incenses me, because for, I don't know how long, I wrote the first two... UNAIDS, WHO global reports on the epidemic. The first one was way back when, in 98, and then in 2000. And even, you know, then we were scrabbling around for good examples, because you've got to show some success stories. You know, we can beat this thing. And one of the good examples by 2000 was Cambodia. It was one of the maybe four countries globally that had managed in the developing world to reverse its epidemic by doing the right thing. And the right thing was to work constructively, not just with sex workers, but also with the sex trade as a whole, so working also through the structures of the sex industry, but also with sex workers' rights groups and et cetera, to greatly increase both condom use in commercial sex and programs for sex workers that focus on healthcare and safety in the workplace. Now, they did that. It was a huge success. And then along comes the America's Trafficking in Persons Report legislation.
Yeah.
So every year, actually you can explain that better than me, I guess, the trafficking in persons, because it's just a mystery to me how that works.
It's a mystery to us, actually, because they've never been able to come up with a clear number. It changes with almost every article that I read on it. And it changes in the U.S., it changes in England, it changes. Nobody's been able to pin down a number, which leads one to believe there is a trafficking problem. It certainly exists, but it does lead one to believe it might not exist quite like they imagine it.
I can't even find a definition. A clear definition of what constitutes someone who's trafficked. But certainly in Cambodia, I will say this, I've worked there for many years, in fact since before the end of the last war, which ended in 1990, and there has been some pretty unpleasant trafficking, particularly from Vietnam into Cambodia, and there's also been a lot of underage sex work. Now, that was given a very, very high profile by the work, particularly of some US-based and religiously inspired non-government organizations including the International Justice Mission, which we in the field call Cops for Christ, because they like to come in with sirens blazing and rescue 13 girls, dump them with a local NGO, and leave the country again.
Yes, I just reread that, actually. You were discussing being a policeman, and he begins swearing at anti-trafficking NGOs.
Yeah. This Cambodian cop was just beside himself. I've never heard such bad language, and I've got a foul mouth. But hearing it from a cop, I'm not allowed to say it on radio, am I? Or but that was effing F through effing, you know, really, really getting upset, because he feels that a small number of ideologues from the U.S. are dictating Cambodian national policy in a way that doesn't accord with the experience of the Cambodian legal services or police force or justice. Now, the Cambodian police, let's face it, are not the cleanest of the clean either, but they have been trying to clean things up, and they've done an okay job. But the pressure ahead of this year's trafficking in persons report was so great that they decided that they were just going to sweep the whole industry. So not just the areas where underage sex workers had been working or were alleged to be working, but just basically shut down sex work in Cambodia with extremely predictable results.
Yes, they have recently released the women. Just in the last week, I believe, they have finally released the women that they were holding.
Yeah.
But
rah, rah. They've released them to no jobs. They've released them to no income. You know, and is this going to make sex work disappear?
No.
Probably not. Is this going to make health and safety health and safety services for sex workers disappear? Almost certainly, yes.
Yeah.
It was one of our international success stories, and we've screwed it up because of, you know, our pressure on a government to comply with regulations so that they get delisted from the trafficking watch list, and we don't even know what trafficking is. We don't even have a definition of it. And it just it breaks my heart that, you know, one of the few countries that was really a good example that we could hype around to other countries and say, look, it is possible in a country that's poorer than yours, in a country that has fewer facilities than yours, to do this well, and here's how you can learn from Cambodia, to see that all reversed.
We have a caller on the line. Hang on 1 second.
It's me.
Oh, hello.
Susan.
Hi, Susan.
How are you?
Good.
Great conversation.
Thank you. You want to contribute on the Cambodian debacle?
Well, you know, I was just listening in, and I wanted to say about the trafficking in persons, the TIPS report that they come out with. It's a really interesting political tool, I think, that the U.S. uses. And ironically, New Zealand had been on it for like 4 consecutive years or something like that, and New Zealand could never figure out how they ended up on it. And I don't know if you're familiar with that whole thing, but every time they put them on it, you know, New Zealand would make a stink, and they would come out and say that this is just ridiculous. We don't have any trafficking. You know, prove it, you know, but at the same time, you're slandering our country and you're making us look, you know, really bad, and you have no proof for this. And it was just purely a political thing. And back in 2004, they had put Japan on like tier something, some tier. And, well, they put a few countries on all these tiers. And then what happens when countries go on this list is the countries that are, you know, pointed a finger at, start scurrying around to try and make it look like they're doing something for trafficking, right? So what happened in Japan was they used to have, some inordinate amount of women would go to Japan every year from the Philippines to work in the hostess clubs. And I was an exotic dancer there, and I used to meet a lot of these women from the Philippines who were in the hostess bars. And they used to come in on entertainment visas, That's what I went into Japan on, was an entertainment visa. And the so they would come in for 3 months on an entertainment visa, and then they would go back home with lots of money, you know, and meanwhile be sending the money back to the Philippines. And the Philippines has a deal with people who work abroad that when they send money back to the Philippines, they I think it goes through the state bank, and the state gets to keep like 10% of the remittances. And so in effect, it makes up 60% of the Philippines' GDP. And so when Japan ended up on this TIPS report, you know, and the U.S. pointed their fingers at Japan, Japan scurried around and eliminated the tourist visas, the entertainment visas for the most part, by making these really strict regulations that the women who came over on entertainment visas had to have 2 years of formal schooling in their entertainment, in their form of entertainment, and had to have 2 years of experience in their form of entertainment, right? It was just ridiculous. And it's, these are hostesses. We're not, you know, the karaoke singers. So so it was just this big joke, but it was so devastating to the Philippines that the foreign minister actually went to Japan to beg them not to put through that legislation because it was going to destroy their economy. Because 60% of their remittances come from these people abroad, you know.
Here's my question. What's the benefit to the United States of putting a country like Japan or New Zealand on this list?
It's political, because it's just controlling people. That's what we
I don't understand how it's got to a point where we're allowed to police the rest of the world in this way.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous.
Why does it... What if the Philippines decided that it was going to have a, absurd visa regulation list or whatever it is, I don't know, and decide that it was going to put U.S. on, you know, tier two of that list and with these consequences? I mean, there would be outrage in the United States.
Yeah, I know.
If another country decided to dictate.
Well, that's the funny thing, is that the U.S. has the most power, and a lot of people have come out, you know, since the TIPS report came out and said, what gives the U.S. the right to point their finger? Who appointed them, world police, number one? And number two, how come they don't look at themselves? Because here they are, all this legislation for the new TVPRA Act, you know, that's all being discussed, and you know, and the numbers that they're using to support this legislation, it's local domestic legislation for trafficking victims in the U.S., and they want, they're discussing making prostitution, period, trafficking, like defining prostitution as trafficking, so therefore putting prostitution under federal regulations, and therefore the FBI would have to then start pursuing prostitution arrests. Which doesn't make any sense, because prostitutes are trafficking victims. Why should you arrest them, right? But anyway, the numbers that they come out to do this, you know, would put them on a tier in the trafficking victim, in the trafficking report. But they don't put themselves on that list. It's just to point their fingers at everybody else. It really is outrageous. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. It's completely hypocritical, and it's just ideologically driven.
But I can't even, I'm so clueless about this that I can't even see. I mean, usually I can see, okay, well, you know, in my business I can see, oh, the drug, big pharma's making tons of money out of this, or it gives Bush a way to give money to his buddies in the Christian right, which out of the PEPFAR money, by the way, they're now close to $2 billion that went straight to his mates in Christian NGOs. You know, usually I can see what the advantage is. In this one, I can't even see it. I can't see what the U.S. gets out of Cambodia scurrying around closing brothels to change its tier. I don't see, except
it
just...
It looks like we're doing good in the world, doesn't it? Eliminating prostitution, saving women around the world. We're doing a real good job.
That might be part.
We're saving them from any way of making a decent income with, you know, with working hours that they can sustain,
exactly,
and also take care of their family. We're saving them from all kinds of things. Yeah.
But they're whores.
Yes.
So, yeah,
that.
It might be an image-building exercise since the U.S. has tarnished its image in every other possible way throughout the world in the past few years.
But who thinks this is a good idea? You know, only the people who are already voting for Bush.
Most people aren't really familiar with these issues. Like, if you talk to the average person on the street in America, they couldn't tell you where Cambodia is. So this stuff
is
completely, U.S. citizens are completely oblivious to this. And when I talk about the TVPRA, people don't even know what it is. People don't know what PEPFAR is. They don't know, they don't know much. So that's where you get that. The other thing
but
was...
Sorry, I'm just curious, do you feel that this whole overseas exercise and that conflation of trafficking with prostitution that's happening through this kind of international initiative is actually having an extra impact domestically in the U.S., or do you think that actually the U.S., that conflation of prostitution with trafficking was already part of the dialogue in the States? Or do you think, I mean, is there an interaction between those two, what's happening domestically and what's happening internationally?
I think it's already been part of the dialogue in the U.S. because a lot of these, high-end or high-profile abolitionist anti-traffickers are U.S. feminists. So, it's already...
Like Donna Hughes, Melissa Farley.
Uh-huh. Two of the big ones.
Yep.
Yes.
And that's what
their strategy.
That's their strategy. Melissa Farley came to Las Vegas recently and wrote this book called Trafficking and Prostitution in Nevada, Making the Connections. And so basically she's trying to define trafficking as prostitution and prostitution as trafficking. In Nevada, she went to the brothels and very selectively interviewed the prostitutes there. Selectively, I say, because I know somebody who runs one of the brothels, and they were surprised to find out that if somebody had anything nice to say about their job, she didn't want to interview them. So she selectively interviewed the prostitutes and then just came up with these outrageous claims that all women in Nevada brothels are trafficked. And she uses statements like, women are moved across borders to work in these brothels. Well, nobody lives in Wells, Nevada, or Ely.
I was
going to
say, in the United States, that's true of everyone in the country in any job, practically.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
That's pretty hilarious. But there was another story that I wanted to tell you about. In 2004, I graduated with a girl from London School of Economics from Hungary, and she had gotten a job with the Hungarian government in the women and children's sector of the government. Mm-hmm. And they were getting ready to meet with the U.S. ambassador and somebody else about trafficking in Hungary or whatever. And so she had contacted me to ask me what I should say and how to prepare her for this meeting. And there was really not much I could say except that they're just going to tell you that all trafficking is prostitution or all prostitution is trafficking, and so that you need to concentrate on eliminating prostitution, which, you know, having gone to school with me, she knew that that wasn't necessarily the case. But in the end, what happened was the other person that met with her that wasn't the U.S., it was the U.S. ambassador and somebody else. The other person that she met with was the head of the U.S. Baptist organization. And what they wanted was Hungary to build a shelter, a trafficking shelter, a women's trafficking shelter on the border, which sounds fine and, you know, amenable, and you think that's a good thing to do. But the U.S. Baptist organization was going to run it. So there you get the U.S. inserting itself into other countries' state policies and state-run organizations.
But that's what is
done
everywhere. Well, Elizabeth, I mean, you certainly have documented that in various spots in your book where the U.S., because it's giving money, tries to essentially control the business of AIDS prevention and AIDS treatment.
Oh yeah, and it does it at it does it even at the level of international organizations. So it has pressed for example, for the UNODC, which is the UN Drugs Agency, to remove any mention of harm reduction from any of their documents. It's fairly overt about the way, but it also restricts, for example, the participation of US scientists in international debates in their own capacity, and they've said you have to, if you work for CDC or NIH or, you know, any of the US funded scientific institutions, which have some of the best brains in the world, some of the most dedicated scientists in the world, those people are not allowed to participate unless they support the US government line. You know, and this is actually documented in a letter from an Undersecretary of State to the WHO. You think that kind of brazen interference is, you know, it's almost as if they don't even get that there's something to be ashamed of there. It's interesting.
Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, sometimes I wonder if, you know, I mean, I do think that we all have our ideologies, and I wonder if I'm not, you know, as subject to holding on to what I believe to be true, just as they're holding on to what they believe to be true. But I just do, I think that, you know, we do have to try and base our understanding of the truth as much as possible on the facts as we not just perceive them, but the facts as we collect them, not from the two girls in the Nevada brothel who hate their jobs and, you know, whatever, as you suggested Donna Hughes might have done, but from, you know, as random a selection of the largest number of people as we can.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, it's difficult not to, I mean, of course we tend to react to ideology with our own ideologies, and I think we have to guard against that and say, but we don't even need an ideology, we've got the facts.
Which brings me to burning question that I have for you, Elizabeth. You've mentioned a couple of times that you're in favor of legalizing prostitution, and I wonder what your thoughts on legalizing versus decriminalizing are, especially in regards to health and AIDS prevention.
I use the term legalizing very loosely, in fact, and I think it varies very much from country to country what the implications. I mean, in some countries there's no distinction between those two. What I would like to see is certainly decriminalization, obviously. I would like to see an industry that has health and safety standards like any other. I don't have as strong an aversion to regular testing and even compulsory, involuntary, whatever. I mean, normalized testing, a screening for STIs, for example, and regular health checks, as many people in the industry do. And that's possibly because I do have quite a strong public health bias, and I've seen it work from that point of view. And to be honest, I probably haven't spent an awful lot of time considering the downsides of that. So I don't make a really clear distinction between decriminalization and legalization, because in a lot of the countries that I work in, the distinction wouldn't be clear. But I do think that we need to have regular health checks, you know, to what extent they're compulsory and to what extent that's helpful, I don't know.
Can I comment on that point?
I'd be really interested to know what you both think, or anyone else who's out there listening.
I just I just read a story about Cambodia, and I was looking into there. I was writing this chapter on the history of the sex worker rights movement, and a major part of that movement happened because of HIV/AIDS and all of the funding that was thrown at organizations, and some people were funding, you know, rights-based worker-centered approaches. And one of the things that came up along the way was 100% condom use policy, which they call 100% cup. And so this policy was touted as this great thing, and that it's going to be great because it was going to cure everybody, you know, prevent everybody from getting AIDS and blah, 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 blah. But what they found happening in Cambodia with this was that a lot of the brothel workers would, the people who were running the program were, it was a top-down approach and not a peer-to-peer approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so the top-down approach meant that you had these NGO workers in there delegating people to, you know, come in, and then you had these mandatory tests and this and that and the other and blah, 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 blah. Well, what was happening is that the women were paying their friends to go in and get tested for them because it was just because they had really bad experiences, because the people who were running this program were very condescending towards the prostitutes. The sex workers, they would, you know, they was like they were disgusted by the whole idea that people were selling sex for money. And it was just a really, really bad situation because there was a lot of judgment. It was judgmental health care, and people didn't want to be subjected to that. So after a bad experience, they would pay their friends to go in and get tested for them. And so it became kind of like a little, like, informal business where people were like, okay, I'll go get tested, you know, and they make all this money. So, therefore, it's really kind of like making itself ineffective in that way.
I think that any kind of bad services, you're going to get that, you know, whether it's compulsory, whether it's voluntary, whether it's, you know, people don't want to use bad services. And I think that what we need to be doing is making sure that we have access to decent and effective services for sex workers, you know, wherever they are. And, you know, I think that the 100% condom use program originated in northern Thailand. Yes, there was certainly a coercive element, but it was at a time when you really, and had an emergency. I mean, we had 46% of sex workers infected with HIV when that program started in the north, in Chiang Mai and Chiang Rai. You know, in Phnom Penh, it was 42%. So you're talking about a total emergency situation.
Yeah.
And I think that response that certainly did have a coercive element, and certainly they didn't put enough effort into making it user-friendly and et cetera, in the early years. But I think it did help to establish norms of both of condom use and of the idea that sex workers have a right to health care and et cetera. That then when the sex workers' rights came along, the movement came along, and Power in Thailand, you know, and the Women's Network for Unity in Cambodia, those did then have a ground to work on, and had common ground with the authorities who wanted these programs in place. So, you know, it's been messy, but I don't think it's altogether a bad thing. What I think we need to concentrate on now is improving the quality of services that are on offer. And in Indonesia, I am absolutely mortified to report that we found in actually some data analysis that I was doing, that the outreach program was going really well. Peer outreach workers were referring sex workers for clinic services. They were coming in. They were getting screened. They were getting treated according to national guidelines. Everything was going really well. And I, of course, you know, with my eye on the funding, went and beat the drum to USAID, who was funding these programs, saying, you know, hey, this is going really well. You know, it's a great success, and we need to expand the program, and blah, blah. And shortly thereafter, the STI data came in, the actual infection data from the lab, and we're making no difference at all.
Really?
And I went, hang on a second, hang on. I go back over all of the other data, and everything else is going well, but STIs aren't falling. I was like, what is going on here? And we sent some samples off for resistance testing, and we are treating, essentially, to put it very briefly, we're treating people with drugs that don't work. So they're according to national guidelines, but the national guidelines are so outdated that the drugs are not working against the STIs that we're seeing. Okay. So you'd think that was something that you could rectify pretty easily, right?
Right.
That was in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
They changed the guidelines at the end of last year, and they still don't have a supply of any drugs that affordable supply of any drugs that do work. 4 years later. So
oh
for 4 years, we've been still running programs for sex workers and giving them drugs that we know don't work.
Oh, my God.
How shameful is that? So, you know, I think we really have to focus on not just, oh, we're doing something. You know, we've got a program. We're funding something. We've got peer outreach workers. You know, we have to focus much more on providing quality services that people want to use, that meet people's needs, and that do the job.
Yeah.
This begs a question. What would be your dream team? What type of people do you think would be best to come into an area, evaluate what needs done, and carry out what needs done? What type of people would you put on your dream team to prevent AIDS in any given area?
I'm all for building partnerships of people who are, I mean, obviously you have to have people from the communities who are most affected, because they're the ones who know what's going on best of all, and who know what the needs are. I do think that you very, very often need to have government representation, and that's particularly in countries where, you know, if you need to do anything at a large scale across a large country, the only institutions with any kind of delivery skills are government institutions. So I think it may, and a lot of people say, oh, you can't get the government to work with, you know, with the sex trade or with drug injectors or whatever. Well, actually, you can. It's very often easier to co-opt those systems than it is to build a parallel system from scratch. So I think where you can get people from the communities working together with people from government, you can often achieve quite a lot. And then, you know, you just need a numbers nerd who is not always looking to the money.
What about, what do you think of Durbar Mahila Samanwaya Committee in India with their self-regulatory boards?
I haven't been involved, and I don't know enough to have an opinion, to be honest.
Okay, well, they've been very, very effective. They're it's a brilliant story. Maybe I can send you a link to some information on them. But they've been just fabulous. They've reduced not only the spread of HIV, they're down to, like, I think they've been at a steady 4% infection rate, which is unheard of in brothel areas. It's a group of sex workers, the DMSC, and they formed self-regulatory boards, and they the boards are made up 60% of sex worker and 40% other people in the community, such as you said, government agents, NGO people, local counselors, city counselors, and like other types of individuals who would have an interest in that. And they've been able to keep AIDS at bay for the most part, and they've also been able to they've been able to address forced prostitution situations, because they have such a network that everybody knows who's going in and out of the brothel area. And they actually have a
Yeah, that sort of regulation is important. I'm curious to know. I mean, Amanda, what would you say would be your dream team for the U.S.?
The U.S. in sex work, obviously, you'd have to get some sex workers from the area, and I think you'd have to get somebody who understands U.S. society. But at the same time, I'm not entirely sure that we want complete U.S. citizens on the team, because I think that people, well, like yourself from the U.K., from other countries, have a lot more open attitude towards sex. So I'd like some scientists and researchers who are a little more broad-minded to come in and make evaluations. And then it, you'd Because you jumped from several you just moved from several organizations, and some of the organizations you worked for seemed heavily tied into AIDS money, and some of them did not. And I think that's also an important distinction that you made of picking someone who is not necessarily heavily tied into AIDS money, because that certainly, as you pointed out several times, it seems to really cloud things.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
I don't know
what exactly type of people you would need to come into an area, research the at-risk populations, and recommend a program that's actually going to work based on other programs that have actually worked. I just would love to see it happen. I just don't know how I would do that because it's not what I do.
I mean, I think the thing is, my feeling is increasingly this, that actually what you need to do technically is not that difficult and not that dissimilar in most places. So, you know, if you take the example of drug injection, you know, you need every junkie to have access to a clean needle every time they want to shoot up. You know, you also want them to have access to methadone programs. In sex work, you know, we know that we need, you know, decent health services, that we need programs that will protect the rights of sex workers and their integrity physically, and that allow organization, all of these things. But so the actual what we have to do isn't so different. The difficult thing is how to do it, because the barriers are not technical, they're political.
Yeah.
And overcoming those political barriers, the political situation is really different in every place. The political situation differs much more than the epidemiological situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the really difficult thing for someone from outside to come in and look at, because so you've got this weird thing. If you're inside the politics, then you're going to be biased, you know, very often, because you have an interest in, you know, you have a vested interest. If you're outside the politics, very often you just don't get it. So you don't understand why it's not possible to do this really obvious thing. For example, getting azithromycin to sex worker services across Indonesia. Why is that so hard? It's a drug. We can, you know, it's not hard to do. Well, actually, it's because, and I'm not saying this is actually the case, but for example, it might be because the person who's head of procurement in the Ministry of Health is tied in with the person who's producing doxycycline and ciprofloxacin. It's stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
It's really stuff like that that gets in the way of doing what needs to be done. And it's very difficult for outsiders to get their head around that kind of thing. So there's always a real balance between people who know the situation but are compromised by it, and people who can see the facts but don't understand why it's impossible to change the facts.
I was wondering, I read your book, and of course I was completely blown away by it. And I'm wondering, because to me, your book has several possible audiences, obviously including sex workers. And I was wondering how you think sex workers can use the information in the book, maybe politically, to get politically or in their personal lives. I mean, obviously, your book is not necessarily about this is what you do to prevent AIDS, although you certainly cover that very well. I'm wondering how you think your book is useful to sex workers.
I imagine that people in any profession, you know, have a broad skills base. I think that sex workers probably have as good an understanding of communication and I guess manipulation of information as anyone else. But I would say that maybe one thing that's useful to sex workers and to other people who are in at-risk communities is to give, you know, I hope that it gives a realistic picture of actually how manipulative we need to be with the data, with the facts, with the experiences, to try and translate those into any kind of programming. So I don't think it does. I mean, I hope it will just encourage people to think, oh, wait, if that's the game they're playing in Washington, in Geneva, in, you know, in the centers of funding, in the centers of policymaking and decision making, if that's the game they're playing, how can we manipulate that game so that it, you know, so that we can play it by our rules and we can get the outcome that we want?
That's what I'm hoping too, because I thought it was very eye-opening, because you really, really have a very good inside view of how all this works politically and financially, stuff that somebody, again, here's the outsider perspective, somebody who doesn't work in that field. I was, certainly my eyes were opened by your revelations.
That just means that I'm more cynical than you are. I guess.
Well, no, seriously, I am hoping that this book can be a bit of an awakening for sex workers, in that it ends up helping us politically speaking, because you don't pull any punches in there. You're very, very forthright. One thing I wanted to ask you, and your one really amusing story to me was your little foray into sex trafficking.
Oh, my God.
Honey girl.
Was that not classic? Yeah, so there I was. Can I tell the story? It was. How much time do we have?
We have 9 more minutes.
Okay. It was just really funny, because I was hearing all this stuff about, oh, trafficking, it's everywhere, and this and that, and I knew that it was so much part of the debate, and it was really skewing what was happening with our funding, because I was working for a USAID funded project. Mm-hmm. And there I am in East Timor, and there are press reports saying, oh, you know, underage women are being trafficked into East Timor and from all over Asia and this and that. And I was like, this is really weird. I mean, I'm looking for trouble in East Timor. I'm out there looking for brothels, looking for, and I've got it, you know, I've been in this business a while. I can usually spot a red light district at about 500 paces, you know, and someone who's a streetwalker or whatever, and I could find barely anything. So there were one or two brothels staffed by Thai women particularly, who were selling sex to UN workers. But apart from that, there was really not much going on. I thought, where are all these trafficked women? And I asked a friend at the UN, and he said, nah, well, I'll find out for you. And then I left town. And when I came back, this guy says to me, so, by the way, I heard that we've got some reports. Are you still interested in trafficking? Because I heard that there are women that are being trafficked in. I said, oh, yeah, tell me more. And he said, yeah, there's a report yesterday, 3 Chinese women who were trafficked in by a UN worker, too. And I was like, oh, my God, that's such a great story. I was so interested, you know, so who's this woman? And I said, well, tell me more. He said, yeah, no, it was 3 Chinese girls. And I thought, God, that's really weird, because I've heard of Thai girls coming in. I've heard of Vietnamese girls coming in, but... And Chinese women are generally not trafficked outside of there's a little bit across the Yunnan border, but they're fairly forceful and not easily trafficked. And I was like, God, that's weird. They're Chinese. I thought, well, maybe, you know, I mean, there's 3 Chinese girls I was talking to at the airport yesterday. And then I thought, hang on a second. And I said, Tim, when was this? He said, oh, it was just yesterday. I was like, and the white girl, who was that? You know, who was the UN employee? He was like, oh, I don't know, some white girl was talking to them at the airport. And I was like, oh, that was it. I was chatting with these 3 girls that I met in the immigration queue who didn't speak good English. My Chinese is better than their English. And so, you know, I was helping them fill out their immigration forms. And the next thing you know, there it is. I'm a sex trafficker. And I just thought, that's the kind of thing that gets into the press, that makes the headlines, and now, you know, every sex worker in East Timor is trafficked. And it was a complete misunderstanding, an absolute nonsense.
And who was at the airport trying to look for trafficked women is what I would like to know.
I have no idea who made that report, and I still to this day haven't found out. But obviously, you know, there's always, you know, UN staff all around the place, and someone who was, you know, hit to this rumor must have just said, oh, God, look. And, you know, and the girls were, you know, they didn't look like they were computer programmers, let's say. So, you know, they were pretty obviously on the game, and here was this white girl helping them with their papers. Therefore, it must be trafficking, just as knee-jerk as that.
It's a good example, though.
I wonder if Melissa Farley has that in her numbers. I wonder if those numbers are in the trafficking in persons report.
Oh, probably. I'm sure of it. But it's concrete. The trafficking is just what you described with a lot of AIDS reports, the beat-up. To me, that's what all this hysteria with sexual trafficking is a huge beat-up, and it's just snowballed.
And it's true, but the same as with the AIDS figures, the thing is, there's also truth in it. We can't say it doesn't happen. It does happen, but the hysteria doesn't help us to deal with it in any way that's rational or helpful.
Well, and they have yet to come up, for instance, with clear numbers, because they have yet to really pin down and find the amount of trafficking cases that they're looking for.
If you ask Laura, she'll say it's an impossible thing to do.
Well, I probably, but at the same time, they can't even give us good numbers on even immigrants, legal or illegal. Well, illegal.
It's an informal system. They don't sign up to become immigrants if they're, you know, immigrating illegally, especially if they're sex workers. I didn't sign up when I went to Japan as an immigrant sex worker.
I mean, I'd be interested to know if, you know, if we could even just get some handle on what proportion of women in the trade are trafficked, for example. You know, if we could get some kind of handle on that. Well, I believe, from my experience, pretty small. I actually believe that it's probably higher in Europe than it is anywhere else I've been involved in this or worked. And I think that the proportion in parts of Europe is now rising. And that's trafficking from other European countries. But even here, is it the majority?
I don't know.
Well, you know, again, it's a very ambiguous thing, because what does it mean to be, what does it mean if you're a trafficked sex worker? Does it mean that you went there to be a stripper and all of a sudden you're a prostitute, or you went there to be a prostitute but you didn't expect to be doing 20 people a day? You know, if you read
Donna Hughes's definitions of it, it includes virtually anyone who was ever told that they could be a nurse when they grew up and ended up doing something, you know, selling sex. Means that you were once promised one thing and now you're doing something else and therefore you're trafficked. I mean, it's practically at that level of absurdity.
The other thing is that it's an illegal, often it's an illegal industry, so it's not going to be, or a very underground industry, so it's almost impossible. It's like saying how many people out there are selling drugs or something like that. It's not a very easy number to come by at all.
Well,
I've got some idea of how people got into the trade from the behavioral surveying. I mean, we've talked to, I don't know, now maybe about 36,000 sex workers in Indonesia as part of a regular tracking system of risk behavior and health service use and et cetera, and we have questions in there about, you know, how you initially got into the business and
really,
and most people, no, it's very, very. We've also got, I mean, that's where all of those. I don't know if you remember in the book, there's a lot of information on comparative earnings. And what women are earning selling sex. And in fact, client turnover in Indonesia, also in much of Southeast Asia, although not in Thailand or Cambodia, but client turnover tends to be quite low in Indonesia, in the Philippines, in China, it's also quite low. I mean, you're averaging 3 and 4 clients a week, up to 7 clients a week, but it's not a lot. And so people are working actually very few hours for comparatively very, very good money. And if you put those data, so you've got data from, you know, over 30,000 women, you can look at their earnings, where they now live against the average earnings in that place. You can look at their earnings now versus the average earnings in their province of origin had they stayed where, you know, where they came from, because it's, there's a lot of mobility within the country in the sex trade. Every single way, you're better off being a sex worker than making Nikes.
Yeah, that is amazing data. Is that enough? I mean, that's all compiled data?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah.
So can I I'm in the middle of a research project, can I call on you for some of that data?
Sure.
But that right there.
A lot of it's in the book, actually, but yes, yeah.
9-country report that almost every single woman in sex work, 89% of sex workers want to exit the industry immediately. That's her.
Well, that one is a, you know, if you ask the question, would you rather be doing something else, which we don't ask, then probably, actually, yes, it probably is close to 89%. If you ask that same question of women who clean toilets in 5-star hotels for a living, it's probably 89%. If you ask that question of women who flip burgers in McDonald's for a living, it's probably 89%. You know, if you ask that of epidemiologists who work for the WHO, it's probably 94%. To say, would you rather be doing something other than your current job?
I know, I agree with you there. But she never says what her questions are. She never publishes her questions, only her statistics.
I have. I'm about to be cut off on my phone, I think, but I've got one quick question for you, which is, who do you think would enjoy my book?
I think anyone who's been interested ever in disease prevention, anyone who has been interested in what sort of effects IV drug use really has, and certainly anyone who's interested in sex work because they're concerned about disease. I mean, that seems to be a humongous concern. And then I'm just going to tell every sex worker that I know to read the book. Very
and simple. Anybody in international politics.
Yes. Anybody who's concerned about where their money is going, funding these programs. Because this is almost, it's not muckraking, but it is exposing so much. Elizabeth exposes so much.
Yeah. Did we lose her?
Oh, yes, we sure did. Damn it.
Aw.
Okay. All right.
Fabulous.
Well, yes. All right. The show is still recording, even though it's not live right now. So I'll just wrap this up. This was Amanda Brooks with guest Elizabeth Pisani discussing her recent book, The Wisdom of Whores, available on Amazon or wisdomofwhores.com, her blog, which I highly recommend everyone reading. And we were joined today by guest Susan Lopez of Desiree Alliance. And this is XBN, Swap East broadcast out of Raleigh, North Carolina, Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina.